Blog Talk Radio.
This is the RF Radio Show with OJ and Gritfish.
Good evening. It's 6:30 Eastern Time, and as always, you're listening to Radio RF. I'm not actually a fish, Dreadfish, here with my co-host, Yes Like the Juice, ETOJ.
But I'm not actually juice either, but I do drink a lot of juice. And you better watch out, Dredd. I also eat a lot of fish, sushi style.
I'm not actually a fish. It's okay. Only when it suits me. I have many forms.
So what have you been up to today?
Well, today I recently got back from disc golfing. And we talked about this on the phone a little bit before the show, and you didn't know what disc golfing was, so I thought that I would talk about that just a moment. I guess it is kind of obscure because I hadn't heard about disc golf until I had actually done it. I remember when I was a kid, I had a neighbor who did disc golf, and I was like, what's that? You know, a lot of people call it frisbee golf, but they're not frisbees. So it's like golf, obviously. You tee off at a certain place. It's usually like a little concrete platform. And now the hole, instead of being an actual hole, is a basket. And you may have seen these in parks. They're usually yellow and metallic colored, and it's got chains hanging down. And the way it works is it has the basket sitting at the base, a little bit off the ground at the base of this pole, and then it's got these chains hanging down. And what those do is when the disc hits it, they absorb all of that movement so it doesn't bounce, and it just hits the chains and falls into the basket. So par and that sort of thing is generally about the same as golf. Most courses or most holes are par threes usually, or par fours if they're really long. So it's the same in most respects except you're using discs. And there are many different types of discs. There are putting discs, and there are long-range discs and mid-range discs and all that. And they're all designed differently with weight or the edge that they have on the edge. And softness, that sort of thing. Putters are softer so that if they do hit the basket in a different point, they don't bounce so far away from it, that sort of thing. So it's a really fun game, and it's open to all kinds of skill levels. Like, you can have people casually walking around throwing discs and enjoying it, but then there are also people who are actually serious, and you can get really technical about it too. So it's really fun.
Now, rumor has it that you were playing bare finned today. Is that correct?
Yes, I've been working on being able to go barefoot pretty much everywhere I want to. This first started as wanting to go barefoot running. And I haven't been running as much because still recovering from the back injury. And it's doing pretty well, but I overworked it the other day, and so I don't want to do too much. But so now I just enjoy going barefoot, and I'm working up the strength and roughness in my feet to be able to take it all. So today I had a victory being able to go throughout the park. And let's see, you know, grass, dirt, some really dry, rough dirt, some pine needles, into the woods, that sort of thing. And it was great. You know, no problems today at all.
Now, I feel like I told this story before, but I once went working barefoot because we were in a lake and ended up stepping on a chainsaw. And that was the last time I really attempted to go anywhere barefoot.
Oh, yeah, you didn't mention that it was in a lake, but that makes sense now that you stepped on the chainsaw.
The chainsaw wasn't in the lake. The chainsaw was on the ground. The tree was in the lake. I was on the ground when I stepped on the chainsaw. But the reason I wasn't wearing shoes was I was working in a lake.
Hmm. Yeah.
So today I heard something, and I was wondering if you've heard about it or if any of our listeners have heard about it. And something about our nation having two flags. One is the peacetime or civilian flag, and the other is the I guess military or wartime flag. And the peacetime flag apparently would have vertical lines on it, whereas the horizontal ones is technically the wartime one. It's only been used since World War II. Now, I tried to look into it a little bit, and it seems to be one of the most bunk ideas I've read about in a while, and maybe the most bunk. I read about a lot of bunk things. But I tried to figure out what it could be based upon, and I found something about a custom service flag that looks like what they're describing, but I haven't been able to find anything credible about this. So if anyone's heard anything about this, could you call us at 646-200-4733? So have you heard about this, Dredd?
I have not heard about this. I'm trying to see if I can find any info. It almost sounds, it sounds bunk, you know, kind of strange to me. So I don't know. It does sound
well,
almost conspiracy-like.
It's passed a lot on a lot of those conspiracy theory websites, and a lot of the links end up leading back to the same website to begin with. So it's catching all of my red flags. And my friend kept showing me all these links and articles, and I was like, no, like, I want a historical document. I want a photograph. I want a physical piece of evidence. I want some actual piece of evidence, you know?
So is the idea that we're at war and we, you know, the regular people don't realize it, that kind of thing?
I guess. I don't even know what the whole – I mean, I guess you kind of happen at war ever since World War II in one way or another.
Yeah. Now, that makes sense. I've heard similar kind of ideas, like people saying that technically we're still under martial law from a long time ago or something, like even back during Civil War era or something, and everybody's, you know, unaware of this except for the people in the government. It sounds like it's pretty similar to that.
Yeah, it makes that sense, though, because then you'd actually see something going on. Have you heard about the thing about the gold trim, meaning admiral admiral law or whatever, or maritime law around the flag?
No.
Another weird thing that I've heard about the flag and secret symbolism and conspiracy stuff. I was actually in an argument with some conspiracy theorists today on Facebook about Sandy Hook being a conspiracy and about the Boston Marathon being a conspiracy. Now, I'm not trying to knock conspiracy theories in general. My issue with these two particular cases of them being conspiracy theories is the lack of motive. Nothing happened. There was no new laws. No war started. No one made a bunch of money. I mean, at least when you talk to people about, 9/11 being a conspiracy theory, at least they can say two wars were started, the Patriot Act was passed, and some rich people made a lot more money. Okay, there's motive. There's an agenda. What was the agenda behind Sandy Hook? What did they achieve? What was the agenda behind Boston bombing? What did they achieve? And in my opinion, it seems nothing changed in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, I think, you know, there is something to some conspiracy theories, but there's definitely, like, for every probably valid conspiracy theory, there are probably hundreds, maybe, you know, 1,000 complete crap conspiracy theories, I think. I kind of thought about that with all the school shootings, and I thought, well, what would that, you know, what is that supposed to accomplish? And I was thinking, well, I guess gun control. But the kind of people, you know, that we usually think about who do conspiracy theories would normally, I guess we usually think about right-wingers and conservatives doing that sort of thing. And obviously they don't want gun control, so I don't see that as actually being a connection at all.
I think you made a mistake with connecting right-wingers to conspiracies. Usually the way I'm seeing it, at least currently, is that the right-wingers and the conservative groups are the ones usually screaming about conspiracy theories. At least currently.
I suppose. Yeah, I guess I'm thinking of a lot of things like taking 9/11, for instance. I guess that's the sort of thing, like, you know, Republicans in office, you know, using it as an excuse to go to war. That idea, if that's true, then, you know, you think of that as the right-wingers doing that. And at least in the case of, you know, school shootings, I don't see liberals engaging in that sort of thing, for that at least. But it's all
again,
theory anyway.
I think if a law was passed, they'd have a valid argument. And that's the thing that upsets me about the whole thing, is that they harass these families, they harass these schools, but they have no motive or no agenda, and they have no really reason to suggest that these things are true. I mean, what, you're going to cause fear? There's dozens of things causing fears every day. And, you know, I don't get it.
Yeah.
So
I think like I said in chat just now, I think people like to have this shadowy, unknowable bad guy to blame for things, you know, just to have somebody to attribute some master over all these things, when actually maybe things just happen and things are a little bit more chaotic than we think.
All right, well, if you disagree with Dredd and I and you think we're missing something critical on this discussion, you can call it at 646-200-4733. So last week, we introduced a new segment, 5-Minute Philosophy with Well-Named, and I kind of rudely forgot to respond to it. So I'd like to briefly remind everyone, last week's topic with Well-Named was about free will, and he basically broke it down into two categories. There's compatibilists and incompatibilists. And I definitely would fall into the incompatible. Oh my goodness, I don't know if I can say this word anymore. Incompatibilist. Is that close? Is that right?
I think that was right. Incompatibilist.
Okay, I'm an incompatibilist. I think outside of the theistic worldview, the idea of free will doesn't really mean anything. And I think in a deterministic world, to use the term free will is distinctly wrong and a way to spread misinformation. And so for those reasons, and I don't want to get too much, because I think this would actually be a much deeper topic that we could go into at some point. But did you have thoughts on that? Which category do you fall yourself into?
Now, I don't remember explicitly the definitions for the categories, but based on like my Buddhist background, that sort of thing, I don't see absolute free will. Given that everything is a very complex web of events, so many things influence so many things. And it's like Carl Sagan said, like if you want to make something from scratch, you first have to create the universe. You know, the entire everything goes into every single thing. So I don't think we have free will. What I wonder is whether we have at least some element of choice in things. So it's like a surfer riding a wave. You know, the wave is going to get to the shore. It's going where it's going to go, but you can kind of move around on it. That's kind of where I'm at right now.
Okay, you might be a compatibilist, but we might need Will Name to call in and let us know where you think you fall in. Anyways, my favorite word, here is today's section. I should delete a bunch of these because I have way too many things to look at to find what I'm looking for. My problem is I'll
you
never
hear that, everybody.
Again. I'm really sorry.
This means that, as always,
we
Radio
shall be
RF.
Discussing philosophy.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
We shall be discussing philosophy with your host, Well Named.
Hello, Radio RF. This is Well Named, and this week we're going to talk about identity. And I want to start by describing identity as a general philosophical question, and then move more specifically to asking about human identity or personal identity. Now, to vastly oversimplify things, I'm going to suggest that there are two basic approaches to the question of identity. The first, which we'll call an analytical approach, says that the identity of a thing is its identification, by which I mean that kind of description which distinguishes it from everything that it is not. And this description is usually formalized in terms of properties, so that A is identical to B if they share every property in common, and A is itself by virtue of its uniqueness. Now, there is a formal principle for this called the identity of indiscernibles, which owes to Leibniz. And the view, in general, follows from this reasonable empirical intuition. How could there be two distinct things that have every property in common? We could never tell them apart, and thus identity really is uniqueness. The second approach, which I'll call existential, sees the identity of a thing rather as its essential and inherent nature, without necessarily referring to the existence of anything else. This approach could be called essentialism, owing to its roots in Greek philosophy in Plato and Aristotle. For example, Aristotle spoke about the idea of things having an intrinsic telos, a purpose, and he said that, in a sense, the purpose of a thing is its identity. In any case, the most important contrast I want to draw is the difference between an intrinsic identity, an inherent nature, versus an extrinsic identity, which is an identification in terms of everything that it is not, uniqueness. Now, both approaches run into some difficulty. With the analytic approach, there's a problem reconciling the apparently simple definition of properties with some of our intuitive concepts about identity. There are paradoxes, for example, that point out that intuitively, we think of a particular thing as remaining, in some sense, the same, even when it changes. But if identity requires having exactly the same properties, and change implies specifically that properties change, then we've already violated our law If the properties change, then it is no longer identical with itself. It is not the same thing any longer. In order to deal with this sort of dynamism, either every property that corresponds to identity must be described with temporal limits, or else really the entire concept of identity has to almost be abandoned. In fact, it was this sort of insight about temporality that seems to have caused Buddhist philosophy to reject the idea of a self, recognizing the impermanence of any human state of affairs. On the other hand, the challenge of essence in the existential approach is that in all of our scientific investigation into the world, we've never really discovered such a thing. In other words, it's the problem of souls or substantial souls. Rather, under our analytic gaze, the world seems to appear to us as this complex aggregate of atoms rather than as simple essences, and identity, likewise, a complex of properties rather than as a simple soul. In short, we've become followers of Democritus and his atomism and not of Plato and his forms. Now, so far, I've been purely descriptive, but what I think is interesting is to reflect on how these two approaches seem to lead to differing psychological attitudes, and if philosophy is the pursuit of wisdom and not just knowledge, it's interesting to reflect on the value of these attitudes. What I want to suggest is that the analytical approach has led to a certain emphasis on individualism. If what I am is defined by how I differ from everyone else, then I must distinguish myself. Even in order to exist in a certain sense, I must be different to have an identity. And in fact, we even use the word distinguished to refer to somebody of particular value. On the other hand, much traditional wisdom, both philosophical and religious, has emphasized the idea that every person has an inherent value. Even our concept of universal human rights seems to require this kind of insight, that inherently, prior to anything that I do or accomplish, I have a value, and that value gives me rights. So, recognizing the strengths and weaknesses of both approaches, philosophically, might we say that the danger of a purely analytical attitude is that maybe it will rob me of a certain existential joy if I reduce life to this purely individualistic competition where I must fight to be different from everyone else. And yet, even if that's true, I also have to come to grips with the fact that, in some sense, my identity is also illusory, as the Buddhist philosophy says. There is no soul as a simple substance that is inside me somewhere. Is there a synthesis of these apparently opposed attitudes? I don't know, but I'm well named, and this was 5 Minute Philosophy.
Again, we wanted to thank Well Named for submitting his section, and this time, I'll be honest, a little bit above my head. I'm not really someone who looks at things in philosophical kind of ways, I suppose. However, it did remind me of a poem I wrote, and I lost the poem a long time ago, but I can summarize it in a way that will tie into the segment today. And the question, I kept asking the question, it was basically about this voice kept asking, who are you? And then I would respond, I am this. But it would be like, but who are you? And I'd be like, I am that. And I would just keep answering by different ways you can identify myself, whether it's some type of title or group I belong to, or thing I do, or something about myself. And I would respond that way. And then the voice kept asking, who am I? Who am I? And then eventually I realized, too late, the voice was me all along.
That's pretty cool. Well, I have a lot of thoughts about it. I really enjoyed today's segment because of my history with Dharmic religions and that sort of thing, and I've been big into philosophy, especially existential stuff. So I guess basing in my kind of Dharmic background, I don't think that there's really any single thing that we can identify as being, what we are. And this is mostly Buddhist. It is within, the Hindu philosophies as well, but most definitely very specifically Buddhist. But and this gave me you know, a lot of thoughts about that too. I really like the identity of its uniqueness, and I'm thinking, well, you know, there's not really anything. Well, everything is sort of a unique collection of things, but everything is still changing. So even that uniqueness changes. But I've just analyzed everything, and I cannot find a single thing that's really me. So one of the questions that I wonder about is, what is it or who is it that thinks it is this or that? You know, or maybe does that question just kind of arise in the mind based on what? I don't know. That's a really tricky thing. My favorite, I guess I would call them Hindu teachers, are Ramana Maharshi and Nisargadatta Maharaj. And people categorize them as Advaitin, but they weren't really anything in particular. They taught from their experience, but they used languages and frameworks of the people around them to convey understanding. But the main practice that they taught was called self-inquiry. And the idea is you ask yourself, who am I? This isn't to get some answer like, you know, oh, I'm this. You're not supposed to have some conceptualized verbal answer. The point is that it brings your attention to this sense of me-ness, you know, this subjective feeling, or what's often described as that feeling of I am. And so you're supposed to just place attention on that feeling and just try to understand it and try to find its source. And so the idea generally is that you're going to find that there's not actually anything there, that it's just this feeling, but there's not actually a being there or an actual thing there. But that's going to be an experiential thing. Just to say it doesn't do anybody any good, because you can go on living your life thinking, oh, I don't exist, but you're going to be engaged in all your normal habits and all that sort of thing. So the point is an experiential, you know, knowledge, and the actual experience of the fact. And we'll get more into this in a couple weeks. We will be doing, most likely on Monday the 20th of April, an episode on meditation and mysticism. So I won't go too much more into this now. Save plenty of material for that. But I'm really looking forward to that episode.
Now, I know you just talked a bunch, but I actually wanted to hear you talk more. You recently spent some time in Malaysia. Could you tell us, A, why you went to Malaysia, B, how long you were there, and then C, about your experiences there?
Okay, so I went to Malaysia because my dad lives there. And he lives there because he married a Malaysian woman. And so, let's see, this past time I went last year was not the first time I'd been there. I went 2 years ago also. I guess maybe it's 3 years ago now. And I only stayed 2 months that time. But the first time, so Malaysia, it's a peninsula in Southeast Asia. It looks a little bit like Florida. And that's West Malaysia or Peninsular Malaysia. The other part of Malaysia is located on the island of Borneo. And Borneo is the biggest island in the world. Part of Borneo is Malaysia. We would call it East Malaysia. And part of Borneo is also Indonesia. And then there's a very tiny Rhode Island-like country called Brunei there. And it's just very small right there on Borneo. So I had also been to Borneo. In the state of Sabah, there's a town called Tawau. It's a little, like, fishing town. Went over there for a week also while I was there. The first time I went to Malaysia, we also visited Batu Caves, which is one of the largest Hindu holy sites outside of India. It's a very old cave, very big, and it's up really, really large set of stairs. There are, I don't remember how many, but it's in the hundreds of stairs. And a very large golden statue of Murugan, which I want to say is Shiva's son. As if there are also smaller shrines with other statues of other devas in there. And there's also a lot of monkeys around there, too. I remember whenever I was climbing up with my family, you know, we stopped at some point, I think, and people carry around food, like a bag of chips. I saw this kid had a bag of chips and a monkey just kind of like hopped over, grabbed the bag out of her hand and then jumped off with it, you know. And, you know, monkeys love to steal food from people. But it was really funny. It was cool to be around all those monkeys. They're macaques. I don't remember which specific type. So that was a really cool experience. More recently, this last trip, I ended up teaching English where my dad taught English, and that was a great experience. I have been an English major. I didn't continue doing that, but that stuck with me a lot, and I'm a writer. So I know, or at the time I knew intuitively, pretty much all about English. Like, I knew how to use everything correctly, but just because I knew this is the way you're supposed to do it, I didn't necessarily remember the reasons why, because who really remembers their English classes or their, you know, grammar classes from grade school? So,
oh, we take it for granted.
Yeah, we do. And, you know, we just use this every day, so we know how to use it. So, you know, I mean, I sat in on my dad's classes. I just went to work with him to hang out, really. And, you know, the other teachers and all that were great, and I just liked being around them. And I sat in on some of his classes, and at some point the opportunity came up for me to teach also. So I started doing that, and I basically learned to teach English while I was teaching it. And I used the book my dad had put together. He didn't teach out of a particular curriculum. He actually made his own, and so I taught through that same kind of curriculum. So that was actually pretty tough, because I pretty much just had to pull stuff out of my ass for about an hour and, you know, teach English. And but what worked was my first student, I just started with one student, and he spoke next to no English, so he didn't know when I made mistakes early on, you know. But, boy, it's really fulfilling and interesting, because before I left, like, he spoke pretty decent English. And I didn't do anything except explain things to him, you know. And it's like, you know, I don't feel like I did anything, but here he is speaking pretty decent English, you know. And all I did was present it, but somehow I had a hand in this. It was really satisfying and fulfilling to do that. And I had other students also.
You plan on going back?
Yes, I do. I was actually going to go back probably this summer, but I ended up having something to do here. But incidentally, we only had one Malaysian student there. The other students were from other countries. Most of the students were Japanese. We had Hitachi would send workers over, you know, usually only about a month, actually, which isn't really enough to learn good English. But they would send people over from Hitachi. We had some guys from Saudi. My first student was from Libya. We had a couple guys from Chad also. And two people from China, too. So I don't know why they chose Malaysia. I think in this case, Malaysia is officially a Muslim country, and so that's probably why. They were all really great guys, though. Saudis are they're cool. They like to have fun. Arabs in general, they're pretty laid back. They like to have fun. Never brought up religion at all, actually, which surprised me at first. And, you know, one of the jokes, I guess, and, you know, this isn't racist because even Arabs know it and they laugh about it. It's just a fact is that Arabs are always late to everything most of the time. And it's just a fact, you know, they'll admit it. It's just, you know, a thing, even in, you know, Arab countries usually. And so, you know, we always like to joke about that too, but, they're really good guys.
That reminds me.
So teaching English was great.
Can you still hear me?
Go ahead.
Okay. Yep. Yeah, when I was taking Spanish, and no, I didn't really learn to speak Spanish, but the teacher would always say, you know, about the culture, and the culture in Spain was that you arrive to parties late, and, like, it was completely different than, like, the way we do it, even though, reason, you know, fashion-related is a thing in our country, and apparently in other cultures, it takes it to a whole new level, but I haven't necessarily experienced it enough to know anything about that.
Yeah, you know, definitely just a different kind of culture thing. America is very, or Americans in general, very punctual. We have to get things done, get to places. But in a lot of other countries and just a lot of other places in the world, it's a lot more laid back. And Malaysia was like that too. People just were more laid back in general. The food, great food, cheap. I think I mentioned on the show last week when we were talking about some globalization stuff, you know, they had McDonald's and that sort of thing, and it was more special because it was a Western thing, and it was more expensive, too. I actually think it was probably better because, of course, the meat had to be halal. I think it was higher quality than it is here. One of the neat things, though, is in Asia, they have things that we don't necessarily have anymore. So they had A&W restaurants there. There was an A&W restaurant in the airport in Indonesia too. And they still had SO stations. Like now we have Exxon, but it used to be SO. Or they still have SO stations. So little things like that are neat. I don't know. What else specifically would you like to hear about?
Do you have any photos or pictures on RF from your time that you have a Diva Media album online?
Not on RF. I actually could bring a couple or have a couple photos that we could put in a slideshow sometime. I didn't think about that, but I do have photos, which actually brings up a good topic. So while I was there, my dad and I took a trip to Cambodia, and the point was to go see Angkor Wat. And anybody who's not aware of what that is, Angkor Wat is it's a really old temple complex in Cambodia that started in Hindu times. I don't remember. I want to say it was King Suryavarman who had it built, but I'm not sure. It does have some old, not murals, but they're carved reliefs, I guess, of scenes from the Ramayana, I think, in it. And so it was used, I think it was actually an entire city complex, basically, yeah. And now there are, you know, Buddhist monks there, that sort of thing. It was really interesting to go in there, see that really old place. And there are some other smaller complexes around the main Angkor Wat. We saw those too. Cambodia was really cool, for a Westerner at least. Everything was very cheap if you're using, Western dollars. Interesting thing is that their currency is so weak that even Cambodians use dollars for the most part to make exchanges. The currency for Cambodia, I believe, is pronounced rial or riel, and it's very weak. It takes thousands of those to meet a dollar. So you might get those back in change for certain things, small purchases, but in general, even they use dollars for stuff like that. So my impression is it's a pretty hard life for Cambodians, but it's very nice for people from other countries to visit. The entire trip there and back to Malaysia, I want to say it was only about $300. That's both, you know, two tickets both ways and stayed. We stayed three nights, I think, maybe four nights, and the place was wonderful. The name was Kanifa Boutique Hotel, and they use boutique in so many things in Asia. I don't know why. Makes it sound nice, I think, but that was a really nice place. It reminded me of some mansion some important British person would have had in colonial days in a foreign country like India or something. Had mahogany walls. Each room was basically just like a room in this large house. And we were actually there when there was no other guests. There were no other guests, and so it was really nice to be there. The, I guess, manager of the place was there, and he took good care of us. Whenever we would be going out, we'd let him know, and we'd let him know what time we'd probably be getting back, and he would be there waiting for us outside whenever we got back. Really nice guy, and so if anybody ever visits Cambodia, I highly recommend Kanifa Boutique Hotel. It was a great place, and
cheap. Breaking news: an interview with Bill O'Reilly. That is right.
This is The Beatdown with Lewis Knott Miller.
G'day, RF, and welcome once again to your favourite online sports segment, The Beatdown, with me, Lewis Knott Miller. I hope you all had a pleasant Easter period, whether you celebrated or not. I got away with the family, did some camping, which was great. Following some pretty good feedback on my last interview with the Australian PM, Tony Abbott, today I'll be interviewing everyone's favourite Fox presenter, Bill O'Reilly. He is promoting his latest book, in which he takes some of our very own RF moderators to task. But before I get to that, a quick recap of the NCAA Final Four tipping. Sadly, my own tips didn't work out too well. Kentucky's loss to Wisconsin in the semis meant I got just one out of the final three games correct. But interestingly, a quick recap of our celebrity tipster.
The first one is Kentucky Wildcats or Wisconsin Badgers. Which one do you think?
Badgers.
Badgers. Okay. And the second one is Duke Blue Devils or Michigan State Spartans?
Duke Blue Devils.
Duke Blue Devils. Okay, so you think it'll be Duke versus Wisconsin in the final? Yeah. Who's going to win the final?
Duke Blue Devils.
How much by?
Pardon?
How many points will they win by? 10. 10 points.
No, 100.
100? That's crazy talk.
So there you go. Amazing tipping effort there by the mystery tipster. Some people have been trying to guess who that is. No, it's not the Queen of England. Anyway, 3 out of 3 there for a perfect score, including the big upset of Wisconsin beating Kentucky. Amazing stuff. Now on to today's interview. Sit back and enjoy as I interview Bill O'Reilly, famous talking head from Fox, on his new tell-all book, targeting, as I mentioned earlier, our very own RF. Welcome to the Beatdown, Bill O'Reilly. On to talk about your new book, Moderation and the God Delusion, a religious forum's expose.
All right, Miller, what's going on?
It's Lewis, not Miller, Bill. Calling me Miller kind of misses the point, you know. Anyway, let's just move on. So, Bill, as you're aware, here on RF Radio, we regularly discuss topics of religion. I thought maybe just to get things moving, you could speak a little bit about your religious beliefs to the audience.
Yeah, I think it's important for every human being to have a spiritual side, and my traditions are Irish Catholic, and I respect the traditions, and I think that for me, it's a good thing, but I don't proselytize.
And in the new book, you run through almost all the mods here on RF, basically putting them to the sword one by one. Don't want to go into all the details. To be honest, I'm a little bit disturbed. I read the chapter on just how extreme Debater Slayer's obsession with Hello Kitty became in 2014, and I'm struggling to get over it. But anyway, have you been able to get enough RF members interested in the book? Is it actually selling?
Even the hedonists and the Wiccans are buying it, so we're very pleased.
Right, and eventually you did start getting some protests in relation to the book, I think, by the
Satanists. You know, they're after me because I said publicly, look, the ideas for all of these books came to me in the middle of the night. And as a Roman Catholic, I attribute that. I believe that comes from the Holy Spirit. So if you know anything about Christian doctrine, that's one of the main things, that each human being is of interest to the deity, and that there is a Trinity, Father, Son, Holy Spirit. And the Holy Spirit is the one who provides inspiration to every human being, and it's up to you whether you take it or not. That's a doctrine. That's a Christian doctrine. Well, as soon as I said that, I get mocked, and oh, God's talking, and, you know, I had to shut down Barbara Walters on The View yesterday with that. And that's fine. That's fine. That's what I believe.
Okay, so on to some of the specific claims made in the book. There's a whole chapter on Sunstone, and you mention, and I quote this, by the end of 2013, he would regularly attend staff functions without any pants on. It got to the point where he had to be bribed with frugals before he would even consider slipping on some tracksuit pants for the duration of a single meeting.
Can you believe that?
Well, frankly, yes. But did you really need to go back into his past and expose his lifelong history of nudist activities? I mean, frankly, the naked bath photos of him, they just didn't seem to add much in the way of context, and it just looked like gratuitous nudity to me. I don't think there was really a point in rehashing his pants-free lifestyle, was there?
But the history of it is thrilling. That's the word. It's absolutely thrilling.
Well, yeah, sure. But a whole chapter devoted to his nude self-portrait phase, 1973 through 1999?
I mean, it's amazing.
And you spend no less than 4,000 words hypothesizing on the rise to supreme power of Quagmire. You describe him as a, what was it again?
Poor laborer, no PR guy, no government, no sports team, no TV network, nothing. become the most famous human being who ever lived. How does that happen?
Well, honestly, I don't know, Bill, but...
It had to do with money and power.
Well, that part interested me even more, to be honest. So you claim in the book that Quagmire, a humble labourer, was financially backed by Mystic Sanger. That seems somewhat far-fetched. Mystic seems nice enough to me. She doesn't really seem a power-hungry maniac. I mean, if you had mentioned someone like Wiry, I'd find it much more believable.
Yeah, but I know her management style, and it's... She's imperious. Word of the day, Miller, imperious.
Imperious? I mean, it's RF, for goodness sake. Why would she even bother trying to back someone into a position of power?
You know, cover-ups of drug and prostitutions and at the high levels.
Come on, that's a ridiculous assertion, Bill. I've been in staff long enough to know that there's absolutely no drugs or prostitution occurring. Even if you wander around with a couple of $100 in your hand, there really appears to be no drugs or prostitution happening, Bill. Take my word for it. Anyway, some people have claimed that much more than simply checking facts, you hired a personal investigator to fabricate evidence for the book.
But I have to have new things in these books and startling things. I'll write them. I'll put the narrative together, but I need the best. And Dugard surfaced, and he had written a few books, one on King Tut, one on Stanley and Livingston, and you know, he's a good writer himself, but the research was fabulous. So we hired him, and the rest is history.
So it doesn't really sound to me like you're shying away from claims that you might have been gilding the lily a little?
As you know, I am a simple man.
And what about the assertion made in last week's 60 Minutes expose, Bill? The one that you spiked Idi OJ's drink with Spanish Fly.
I didn't think it was going to do anything, Miller.
I told you before, Bill, it's Lewis, not Miller. Not just Miller. Man, that's confusing. Anyway, you owe me $200. That's how much it cost me to bail Idi out when the cops realized the chicken was unharmed. There's lots of people upset with this book, Bill.
But I think Jesus is going to be happy with this book.
Okay. Well, anyway, just aware of the time, we're going to need to wrap this up. Thanks for your time today, Bill. And thanks for leaving me out of your new book, Moderation and the God Delusion, a religious forum's expose.
All right. Thanks, Miller.
All right. So that was Bill O'Reilly. Okay, RF, I'm going to try to do better next time. Until then, Lewis Not Miller, signing off.
Sorry about the sudden transition before. I just felt it was important to bring you this broadcast live as he grilled him just for you. However, had I known he was going to mention the Spanish Fly incident, I might have just not even played the segment today. So thank you for that. Well,
right.
As you know, today's episode is named Spring into Radio RF because it's spring, and I know it's been spring for like a week or two, but it's finally got rid of the snow in my area, and actually last weekend I just started planting my garden. Not outside, it's still too cold and the weather's not right for it, but I have my little sprout thing and I've got some sprouts growing right now. I'm actually looking at them. And so I figured we should talk about spring and summer gardens. Particularly for me, I like to grow crops. So this year I plan on growing orca and tomatoes. Okra. Orca is a whale. Okra is a vegetable.
Well, you'd have to have a lot of space to grow an orca.
To be honest, not really. I grew them last year, and it was it didn't take up that much space. You know, they were stunted. They got clipped by, like, some deer, so they kind of got stunted in their growth. But the thing about them that's really great for growing is they have a long harvest season, and they're quick to harvest. So once you get your first harvest, you harvest, like, every 2 days off of a plant, and just a couple of plants, you can be eating it every week.
So I know in the South we eat fried okra. Do you do that in the North?
I mean, I don't eat fried okra. What I do is I actually stew it with tomatoes, personally.
Oh, we've done that too. Yeah, that's pretty good.
Yeah, that's my favorite way to have it. I've made pickles with them, and I'm not really a good pickle maker, so that didn't come out too well, but we'll try that again. I didn't really like the fried orca. I mean, it tasted good, but it kind of gave me a stomach ache. So I probably, I don't know. I just really like to stew them. It's so good that way.
Sounds good. We have done some gardening in the past, but It has generally kind of failed because we've forgotten that our herb garden was out there. Usually we've just grown herbs. Incidentally, there's a funny story about that. On one side of the house, we thought this is a great side for a garden because it gets a lot of sun at a certain time of the day and all that. And it just looks like it would be good for rows of vegetables and that sort of thing. And I don't think I was away at college when this happened, but they had vegetables out there and all that stuff. And then one day they went out there and everything was just gone. And don't really know what caused it. We're thinking that some deer must have come by and eaten it all or something, just pulled the plants right out, or maybe just, truant, went out and decided to mess with somebody's garden, but the entire thing is just gone. So we haven't
even really the roots and stalks?
Apparently, yeah. I wasn't around to see it, but that's what I've heard.
I'm imagining gophers burrowing underneath your garden and just yanking the plant straight down to the ground.
Yeah, that's true, gophers. I don't think we have gophers, but I don't know. We generally have grown herbs. Ever since I was a kid, actually, we've usually
had herbs.
What
herbs do you like to grow?
The mainstays are like thyme and rosemary. We used to have a huge rosemary bush. It had like a 2-inch thick trunk and all that. But unfortunately it ended up dying of some disease, but we had that for years. I'm a fan of basil. That's my favorite herb, I think. And, it's holy for a reason. I love basil. One year I even found, I didn't know existed, cinnamon basil. That was really nice. It tasted like cinnamon basil.
Oh, there's like hundreds of different flavors of each herb. Like, it's not just oregano. There's like dozens upon dozens of varieties of oregano. And actually, I think my favorite herb to grow is cilantro, because first you get this great cilantro flavor, which goes great in a variety of different dishes. But then when it comes time for it to set the seed, you continue to grow it, and then you pull it out and let it dry, and you have coriander. It's two herbs for the price of one. It's great. And it grows excellent in my area. So if you get the slow boat one, it grows very well and abundantly. I think oregano and parsley are my favorites to grow as well. I mean, I know they're kind of the simplistic ones.
Yeah, we used to grow parsley too. I think it was flat leaf. Or curly leaf. To be honest, I don't remember specifically what the leaves were like. growing up, one of my favorite things to grow was chives, because I would just, pick a piece off and eat it, when I was a kid. I loved those. One of the things we used to do...
Chives growing right now. I had it in the garden last year, and it apparently re-sprouted it. I think it actually grows from the root.
Yeah. One of the things we used to do whenever I was a kid, and I'm surprised that fewer people do this than I thought, but we used to drop the pumpkin from Halloween, or a couple of pumpkins, and just drop it on the ground in a spot somewhere, and we would have pumpkins grow. And usually they were kind of small. We didn't really cultivate them to be large. We just let them grow, and trimmed any leaves or branches that needed to be trimmed. But it was, had pumpkins every year. We'd just recycle our pumpkins in the same spot and continue to have pumpkins each year. So that was always fun.
So I'm going to get into some more detail about gardening itself. And now, if you wanted to chime in on this conversation, you can call us at 646-247-33. Are you growing in the year now? What are you growing? How much do you grow? How often do you grow? I think there's a lot of things to consider. First of this is the size of your garden. It is going to depend on the size of your property. I live in an apartment complex, so to the areas that I find they grow things are, it's kind of small, but I have some area around a porch I can use, which is nice. Like I said, right now I'm actually starting things indoors, and that's very important, especially in an area like mine. I live in New Jersey, and we have a shorter growing area than others, but we have a long enough growing season to grow things like tomatoes and stuff, so it's a good growing season. But to get the most out of it, it's very important that you sprout seeds inside, so by the time you reach the last frost date is the next month, on the 5th, I believe. So keep that in mind. I tried growing beans last year, and it failed miserably, so I'm just going to skip beans because I think I have some of the bean disease in my ground. And that's something you definitely have to watch out for. I'm going to try actually planting up front because the backside where I have my main garden and my compost pile is south-facing wall, which is actually why we chose this apartment. We wanted a south-facing balcony for gardening. So we do some gardening in pots as well. But I'm going to try to do up front, and it gets very little sun, but I'm hoping I can grow some lettuces and some other greens. They're kind of easy to grow, and you can grow a lot of them, and you can grow them repetitively. I'm just hoping there's enough sun up front for it.
Yeah, I wish I knew more about this stuff. Like, my dad always did a lot of landscaping with our yard as I was growing up, and he used to work for a landscaper. He loved gardening, all that. But I've lost a lot of the knowledge because I haven't really done it very much. But, you know, it is really interesting, and it's satisfying to grow your own food and herbs and that sort of thing. And me being sort of a naturalist, and I like to be, I guess, self-sustaining, that sort of thing, I would love to get into growing.
That's my draw to it as well.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, to be honest, everybody should be growing some of their own vegetables, and that would solve a lot of problems.
I think it's necessary to somehow survive as a species. I think it's going to become very, very important for us to get to that stage eventually.
Yes, I think that's should be taught in schools, you know, how to grow food. I mean, so basic. We ought to all know how to do that.
That is true. Now, I mentioned I had a compost pile, and the reason I have a compost pile is, A, it's a great way to make soil that's rich in nutrients for your plants, which makes plants that are rich in nutrients for you. However, part of my reason for also doing it, besides the obvious, what am I doing, you know, instead of throwing away things that have a second use and just to make the healthy soil, is I want to make raise the soil around my garden a little bit so I can do slightly raised beds and increase the amount of volume I can grow in that by increasing the soil health and how hot it is and how loose it is. Now, what was really surprising is how I was able to get away with having a compost pile in an apartment complex. That took quite an accomplishment. Actually, they just didn't pay any attention.
Yeah, I had a friend who her mother always composted. There was a little bin. You know, there was a tiny little trash can she kept on her counter, and, you know, anything like cutting onions or whatever, you know, she would just put stuff like that in it. It was pretty nasty during the summer, but, you know, other times, I appreciated it, but there would be, end up being maggots growing inside the can and all that stuff, even though she took it out pretty often. But composting is a pretty valid thing.
Yeah, it's definitely clutch if you're going to be doing any amount of serious gardening.
Yeah.
And what's really good is it can save you a lot of money on top of this. It's like, if you garden a lot, you know you have to amend your soil. And the best way to do that for free is by composting your organic waste. Now, if people have questions about certain topics of this, like I can go into more detail, whether it's on RF, in a PM, in a thread, or on another episode. If you have more questions about how to properly do any of this type of stuff, especially something that I've been exploring, eventually I actually want to move on to a farm and kind of get into homesteading. So I've been slowly doing research and practicing what I can, and I am by no means an expert, but hopefully I know the answer to your question, but if not, it just means I need to research more. So either way, asking me can either help you or me or both of us.
Oh, and we have one comment from the chat room. Apparently in Australia, they pronounce the H in herbs. Our resident Australian.
Yes, I love Australia.
Keller,
yeah.
He said that we sound funny pronouncing it that way. So that means if you guys go down under, that means you're going to hear people say herbs instead of herbs, apparently. I don't know.
All the time in America, and people make fun of me left and right.
So I know. I like the way it sounds to say herbs, but if I say it, anybody around is going to look at me funny like, dude, why are you saying it that way? It's herbs, you know.
Two questions about this. One, how is the growing season in Australia? And two, is it true that the crops can also kill you like everything else in Australia?
Boy, you know, they actually have carnivorous plants in Borneo. They're the corpse flower because it smells like a rotting body, apparently, but it eats very small things. I thought that was interesting.
Wait, what? Wait, I'm sorry, I missed that.
Well, in Borneo, I don't think in Peninsular Malaysia, they have a carnivorous plant. It's called the corpse flower because it smells like a rotting corpse. It smells awful, apparently. And it's you've probably seen a flower kind of look like that before, but you know, definitely recommend looking it up. Interesting random knowledge, but it eats small things. Things fall into it, you know, that sort of thing, and then it just digests them.
Okay. Kind of like a flytrap, but not really?
I guess similar. I remember having a flytrap when I was a kid. I was so disappointed when we didn't have enough flies and it died.
You know, they don't really need to eat flies. You just kind of need water and healthy soil like other plants. They don't really need to eat too often. And you can feed them, like, I believe, meat on top of just bugs, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, and I have heard that you can overfeed them. Apparently there's a refractory period after they close their mouth. So if you trigger their mouth, you know, then you're basically going to be starving them a little bit, apparently.
What happens, actually, is that they can only close each head 3 times. So by triggering it, you actually kill the plant.
Oh, okay. Oh, yep, I remember hearing that now, yeah. It's really interesting stuff. I love plants.
And again, yes, you can overfeed them. It's not really, they don't need to eat bugs too often. Yeah, otherwise you can really kind of just treat them like a regular plant. You know, I think one of the biggest issues is people don't ever change the pot they get. They buy these plants and they don't upgrade it into a larger plant like you would with some of the other plants you buy.
Sure.
And
mm-hmm.
And they overfeed of flies and, you know.
Yeah, a lot of people
like
don't.
Do that?
Yeah. Yeah, and a lot of people don't realize that they need to put their plant in a bigger pot whenever it grows, or it'll get root-bound and basically choke itself to death. So that's always important.
So I would like to get into this topic some more on another episode, and possibly multiple episodes throughout the spring and summer, because I'm going to be busy with my garden for the entire growing season. So I think we'll do more segments on this, and I think it'll be a little bit more detailed next time. We kind of just thought that talking about gardening, we had plenty of sharing gardening, but I didn't really have any direction, and I think it shows, and I apologize for that. So next episode, or next time we bring up gardening, there'll be a little bit more detailed of a reason to talk about it other than just like, yay, gardening. We did have a song into today that was brought to us by Red Economics. Oh my, I can't pronounce anything today.
Red Economics.
You know? Yes, there we go. The song is called Child Prodigy, and thank you for sharing this.
All right, folks, that's all we have for you tonight. Like Lewis Miller always says, we'll do better next time. Good night, good morning, good afternoon.
Good now.